This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Following an eviction order from the city, many Occupy Boston protesters pack up and left, but a few remain in Dewey Square. But for how long? And what's next for the Occupy movement?
This movement will continue. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be here for a very, very long time, whether or not we are physically located in Dewey or otherwise.
Also this week, a billion-dollar casino proposal for Foxborough from gambling mogul Steve Wynn and Patriots owner Robert Kraft gets a mixed reception.
Steve and the Kraft Group have no interest in doing anything in the community that the community doesn't want.
And on Beacon Hill, a battle over leadership in the House.
The reason I resigned is because the Speaker thought it was a good idea to bring members in a week or two before Christmas to fire me.
And 12 years after the deadly cold storage fire killed six of his colleagues, a Worcester firefighter dies under similar circumstances when a blazing building collapses on top of him.
Those are some of the stories we're looking at as part of our Week in Review this afternoon. Joining us now is Kyle Chaney, reporter at the State House News Service. Hi, Kyle.
Hi there.
And Joan Vanocki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Joan, pleasure to have you as always.
Nice to be here again.
So let's start with Occupy Boston, the protest movement smaller today than it was yesterday. The city of Boston gave the protesters a midnight deadline to clear out of Dewey Square. Many did, but the hour came and went. And as of this afternoon, the Dewey Square encampment remains in place, though much diminished. Here's Mayor Tom Menino talking about it this afternoon in Brighton.
They haven't been a real issue in public safety. They're voicing their opinion on some issues. But they were trespassing on property that the judges said that it's not allowable, and that we will take appropriate action in due time.
Now, there's no sense what that means, take action in due time. But, Joan, let me start with you. What do you make of the city setting a deadline, but now not giving any indication of the next step?
Well, the mayor seems to have played this whole thing very carefully from day one, not wanting the kind of confrontation and negative headlines that have come out of other cities. And you're right. I mean, I don't know exactly how or what he plans to do if they all don't, just go away as he wants them to. I guess we'll see as it unfolds over the weekend. He's going to have to make a final decision at some point.
Yep, and that's going to probably involve some sort of police action, one would think. Here's Boston Police Superintendent William Evans.
We're going to work with him. I know the mayor's always worked with him. He's been great. And hopefully, over the next couple hours, over the next day, they'll move out. Voluntarily, and leave on a high note, because no one wins if people get hurt and people get arrested.
So that was from earlier this afternoon. That was Police Superintendent William Evans. You could hear the drumming in the background. Kyle, many of the protesters have, in fact, moved out, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Dewey Square will just peter out peacefully, or what's going to happen?
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised that it petered out as much as it did peacefully. People just sort of said, okay, we have till midnight. We're gonna pack up and go. And I think that caught definitely some reporters off guard and some observers of the Occupy movement in general, especially when you compare it to how it's gone in other cities. I don't know. I think it's a little bit of a brinksmanship here. The mayor set a deadline to see what that effect that would have, and clearly it did move some of the protesters out, but then there's the more hardcore contingent that don't want to go anywhere. So.
Yeah. And Joan, what do you make of the way the police have handled this so far? It seems like they've been operating with a good deal of restraint. Do you give them high marks so far?
I would give them high marks, and I'm gathering that they're taking their orders from the mayor, through the police commissioner, and for whatever the reason. And I think there's a really interesting story to be reported on and told, and I don't know the answer to it. What was Menino's strategy from the beginning? Why did he decide that this was the way to do it? Politically, there was a lot of stake, and he definitely took a different look at it than other places did.
Mm. Well, police have cleared out Occupy encampments from New York and Philadelphia to Los Angeles and Seattle and other places. Protesters with Occupy Boston say their movement will live on, whether in Dewey Square or elsewhere. What happens to the future of this movement, Kyle, do you think?
Well, they've got a new slogan now, which is, I think it's you can't evict an idea. And I think this has been sort of the whole message all along is it's not from some of them on the ground is it's we're not just here to sit here in tents. It's we actually espouse some ideas. Actually, the mayor, interestingly enough, took issue with their message and said it wasn't clear enough or wasn't focused sharply enough the other day. But they're hoping that the messages they did talk about in terms of economic inequality lives on a little bit beyond whether they have a physical presence.
Well, of course, that's been a criticism from the start that they haven't been focused. But on the other hand, there are people that will say that the Occupy movement has already affected the debate in substantial ways across the country and in Washington. Do you think that's fair?
I think that is fair. I mean, for the past 2 months, they've driven the news and the headlines. The idea of breaking it into the 99% and the 1% does live on as an idea. I think they're going to have to regroup and decide what the next phase of this movement is. But I think they can look back and say that there was some success achieved out of it.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch what happens to the folks in Dewey Square over the weekend and to the movement in general going forward. Let's move on to another story. This week, Las Vegas casino mogul Steve Wynn and Patriots owner Bob Kraft proposed building a $1 billion resort casino in Foxborough. More than a few residents there have already rejected the idea. They don't want the traffic and all the accompanying social problems that a casino could bring. For his part, Jonathan Kraft, CEO and president of the Kraft Group, said a casino would be just one part of the resort.
What Steve is talking about doing here is building a destination resort, which will have many components to it, one of which will be a gaming hall, but the resort itself will be designed as a facility where meetings, functions, conventions, people coming from all over can come there and experience something and never touch or be exposed to the casino.
Joan, what do you think? Does that argument persuade you?
Does that fly? Not exactly. But it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the people of Foxborough think. This is going to be a real test for the theory or the, you know, all the polling has shown that people in Massachusetts want casinos. But more specifically, do they want one in their own backyard? Even one attached to a convention center? And my second thought is that I always see these in terms of politics and power struggles. And here we've got a real big one because in Boston, you've got the Suffolk Downs crowd that wants a casino. And the last time I checked, there already is a convention center in Boston. Mm. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. Kyle, what's your take on this? Does a casino next to Gillette Stadium make sense to you?
I mean, I don't know about whether it makes sense or not, but it is surprising to see the Kraft, you know, Bob Kraft come out ahead on this idea and to be pretty significantly rebuffed at the local level. You know, he's a guy who's business sense and is apparently, you know, he's so in touch with the community down there. I don't know if he saw it coming that Foxborough was going to push back so hard, even rejecting the idea of a zoning change to incorporate the casino into the local plans.
You know, it's good that you mentioned that because I wanted to bring that up. Yesterday, the town planning board, as you said, rejected some of the zoning changes that could have benefited Wynn and Kraft's plan. But what struck us here was that 500 people showed up at that hearing, 500 people at a zoning board hearing, which sends a pretty strong message, don't you think, Joan?
It's on the surface, it does. I'm always curious and suspicious. I wonder if any of them had any connection to Suffolk Downs. That's just, you know, pure speculation on my part. Or it could also be, you know, from the town's perspective, you know, looking at it from, you know, part one of negotiation. What do we get out of this? I think they did reserve the right to reconsider this in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's off the table forever. But if you're the Krafts and Steve Wynn, it wasn't exactly the warm embrace that you might want to get for this kind of an idea.
Mm. Well, after a long debate about whether or not to have casinos at all, now it seems like we're heading into a season of long debate about where to have them. I guess that's going to be an interesting one to watch for a while. Do you think, is there going to be a sort of pitched battle wherever a casino is proposed, Kyle?
No question about it. I mean, the opponents at the state level have already promised as much, not just at the local level, litigation and definitely local fights. I mean, it's the whole not in my backyard phenomenon, which is you know, casinos might be great in concept and they poll pretty well statewide, but when you say, would you take a casino in your town, it's a different question and might have different results.
Hmm. Let's move on to another story briefly. Kyle Cheney, this week the dust was flying on Beacon Hill as Speaker of the House Robert DeLeo clashed with Majority Whip Charles Murphy, who resigned his position. Murphy says he was forced out because of his outspoken desire to someday take over DeLeo's seat.
I think what led to my demise was my desire to be in that fight when the time comes. And I've been very clear with members that when Speaker DeLeo decides to move on, for whatever reason, I would like to move forward and run for that position.
Kyle, can you give us some of the background here and tell us a little bit about what's going on?
Yeah, this is one of those inside the Capitol fights that people outside the 02133 zip code don't really follow with great vigor. But it's important because this is about the Speaker of the House is the most powerful office in state government. And this is about the way that power is transferred to the next speaker. And Charlie Murphy, who's been sort of a lieutenant to Speaker DeLeo for a while, has now been demoted in part on the suggestion that he was angling to become the next speaker. Mm. So it's a little bit of this cloak and dagger, really inside baseball type of maneuvering among state lawmakers, but it does have implications for the future.
Is there, there's talk that there's actually a split among the House Democrats over this leadership battle. Does that mean that Murphy has a bunch of clout up there? Or
That remains to be seen. I think he hopes so. I think he'd like to think that members are on his side. A lot of people did question the timing, why they had to have a whole special meeting just to fire Charlie Murphy from his leadership post over this jockeying at a time when most lawmakers are on recess from major action here. I think, I'm sure Murphy hopes that that a lot of the members are with him on this one.
Joan, how does this inside baseball political fight on Beacon Hill strike you?
Well, my first thought is, if I recall, now Speaker DeLeo did some angling himself for the job. So it's not exactly unheard of that, people in leadership position themselves to be the next speaker. The second thing, why it should be of interest to people beyond Beacon Hill, is that whenever people try to understand why does the House Speaker have so much power, why does he always get what he wants? Because the people, if the other lawmakers don't give him what they want, he takes away their leadership position. He takes away their office. That's how he keeps control. And people should understand that that's what's going on there.
And Max, to that point, Murphy raised that in a very explicit way that few House members actually do when after he was demoted. Raise those exact points. So that was a rare display of candor from a formerly high-ranking member.
Hmm. Who will now be working out of a broom closet somewhere.
Oh, boy. Well, listen, finally, I want to take note of the tragic death of a firefighter this week in Worcester. 43-year-old John Davies was killed yesterday when a flaming triple-decker in Worcester collapsed on top of him. He was a father of four. He'd gone into the burning house to search for a tenant who was thought to be trapped inside, but then became trapped himself when the back of the building collapsed. Here's Deputy Fire Chief Jeffrey Gardell.
He was assigned to Engine 1 back in 99 and was one of the first firefighters on scene at the Worcester Cold Storage warehouse fire. Our thoughts and prayers of the department are with his family and John.
So that 1999 cold storage warehouse fire killed six firefighters, now known as the Worcester Six. After the blaze, the Worcester Fire Department strived to better protect its firefighters. But no matter what, as this story reminds us, this is a brutally dangerous business, and firefighters will continue to put their lives on the line. Joan, what is there to say about this beyond all kinds of sympathy for the family of John Davies?
Well, sympathy, and just, I guess to repeat a version of what you said, that a routine day of work for a firefighter is a lot different than a routine day of work for the rest of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's move on to our weekly hubbub, that story that perhaps wasn't on the front page that should have gotten more attention than it might have. Let me start with you, Kyle.
Sure. Well, I mentioned the Governor's Council on this show before. It's the eight-member elected body that votes on the governor's judicial nominees. And they're chaired by Lieutenant Governor Murray, and they're an increasingly unpredictable bunch. And this week, not that they vote down the governor's picks, but they do tend to end up with a lot of tie votes. And when there's a tie vote, What usually happens is the governor comes in and Lieutenant Governor Murray breaks the tie. Well, this week there was a tie vote, but the governor was down in Brazil. So there, he was not available to come allow Lieutenant Governor Murray to break the tie. And it created a heated exchange among counselors. And the fight may end up in the Supreme Judicial Court to figure out whether Lieutenant Governor can break the tie without Governor Patrick present.
Very interesting. You're seeing all kinds of interesting inside political stories up there this week,
yeah,
Kyle.
No kidding.
Magna, let me bring you back into our conversation. Your hubbub.
So, you know, earlier you were talking about how Foxborough is dealing with important zoning considerations regarding casinos. In Lynn, there's other sort of city-based topics that one of them I want to pick up on, and that is that a magistrate court in Lynn has decided to issue criminal charges against an 80-year-old woman for feeding ducks.
Oh, boy.
Mostly because she feeds them masses amount of foods, and they're littering with ducky doo-doo, if I could say, a local pond. But she says she's not going to stop, even if they press charges against her, because the ducks belong to God.
All right. There's a story about ducky doo-doo. Joan Vanacki, see if you can top that one.
Well, mine's a little bit less lighthearted. I was thinking about House Speaker Sal DeMasi, who began an 8-year sentence in Lexington, Kentucky, which is very far away from Boston. Joe Lally, the person who he sort of did his business with in the State House, cooperated with prosecutors, and he got an 18-month sentence at the much closer Fort Devens here in Massachusetts. Judge Mark Wolf said that he was trying to send a message by helping Lally get closer to home, and I guess I want to say that he did send a message that prosecutors have a lot of power and cooperating with them does have its benefits.
Wow. So here's my hubbub, and Joan, this one is for you and your venerable industry, which means a lot to all of us. So it turns out there's a new study that has concluded that newspapers make us more trusting. According to researchers at the University of Washington and Colby Sawyer College in New Hampshire, the study found that people who are frequent readers of a daily newspaper tend to be more trusting of others than those who read a daily paper much less frequently. So I find that very interesting. The study comes from the Mass Communication Society. It concludes that newspapers help make communities better places to live by reinforcing feelings of trust. Now, I don't know if they looked into what the effect of frequent radio listening is on people's trust, but I'm going to assume that would be a good thing as well.
Let's hope it also makes them better informed.
Joan, does it make people who work at newspapers more trusting?
The readers will have to speak to that.
We're not all bastions of cynicism.
Well, our very able and capable producer and director, Don Mozzi, said to me, makes people more trusting? Is that a good thing? So always the skeptic among us. That's also what makes journalists. Listen, thank you all very much. Joan Vanacki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. And Kyle Chaney, reporter with the State House News Service, thank you as well.
Great to be here.
Stay with us. Up next, the real Mother Teresa, author Mary Johnson on 20 years as a missionary of charity. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.